just to give you hope. I won't look at it, but I want you to know every time I look at the podium, it should give you a little hope that I'm going to quit sometime soon. I'm a grateful, enthusiastic, and very active member of the Al-Anon family groups. My name is Jack Carpenter. I want to welcome the newcomers. I notice they're all in a group back there. The CDC would call that a cluster of newcomers. For the guy that was in that group, my experience when I came to Al-Anon, I was the only guy also. And those women conspired to throw me under the bus on a regular basis. Every time anything needed to be done, I got to do it. I got nominated to go do service positions and fill positions doing that. And I got nominated to go beyond the group. And my first year in recovery, a lovely lady, my friend Mindy C. We just buried Mindy. She died of cancer a couple of months ago. But 35 years ago, my first year, she decided they were going to write a skit to celebrate our anniversary at this meeting I was going to. It was me and 70 women. So she wrote a skit. It was called The Garden of Life. And as the only guy in the meeting, I was nominated to play the alcoholic weed. I still have the pictures. Whose job it was to seduce Miss Daisy, the newcomer. So, buckle your seatbelt. It can be a bumpy ride, but I hope you stick around because I did. This morning, I'm a very early riser. I got up very early this morning. I got up and got a shower, and I got down to the restaurant when it was still pitch black dark outside. I like to go have a little time by myself and sit and do some meditating and get a little breakfast and a cup of coffee. And I talked to my beautiful wife in Tennessee. She's an hour ahead of us on time zone, so I knew she'd be up. She was probably up 2 hours, an hour before I was. And a couple of guys walked up to the table and they asked, "Are you busy?" And I said, "Well, I'm sitting here having a cup of coffee with my beautiful wife watching the sun come up." And he looked around the table and all the chairs was empty. I said, "Well, she's in Tennessee, but she's watching the same one I'm watching." And we have this connection that we have as a result of recovery, as a result of the 12 steps that were given to us by Alcoholics Anonymous, and as a direct result of the application of the 12 traditions as the operating system for our home. When I get up here, I never have any idea what I'm going to talk about. I really don't. I do a prayer before I get up here. I do a little peeing, do a little praying. Might be too much information for you, but that's what I do. I remember when I was real new, went to an Al-Anon speaker meeting, this lady got up to the front of the room, and she said, just before I got up here to the podium, we're at this little dingy church not far from where I used to live in California, and I went in that bathroom, and I got on my knees, and I asked God to tell me what to say today. Now, I'm pretty new, and God is certainly not on the table for anybody the likes of me. And she's wearing a nice dress, and all I can think about for her entire talk, I didn't hear a word she said. I just kept thinking, "Oh, my God, honey, you're going to have to burn them pantyhose." that bathroom was a cesspit. She was on her knees in there in the pantyhose, and I heard absolutely nothing else. But before I got up here today, I go do a prayer, and the prayer is, "God, please put your love in my heart, your thoughts in my mind, and your words in my mouth." Then it's his talk after that. It's not my fault if it sucks. Call your sponsor, talk to God. It's not my deal anymore. I've been around here for a while. Since February the 19th of 1990, I have not found it necessary to bring my drunk girlfriend home to meet the wife and the children. And I am not an alcoholic, but my story sounds pretty alcoholic to my friends. People will come in late to the meeting, and they're sure they just came to an AA meeting, because from this point on, we're going to talk about the disease of alcoholism and how it affected my family and how I reacted to it. The problem wasn't the disease, it's how I reacted to it. I was having a little bit of coffee with Tiffany before the meeting, and I told her a story, which I guess if friends of mine call me up and say, "I'm speaking at a meeting, I don't know what to do, what do I do?" And I tell them all the same thing. If you're talking at AA and they introduce you to an AA meeting, everybody in the room is leaning slightly forward like they're ready for the thrusters to kick on the jet to go down the runway, ready to go, and they're only waiting for a single thing. They're waiting for you to tell them that you drank. And the minute you do that, my friend in AA told me, he says, the minute you do that, they relax, they sit back in their seat, and then they don't pay any attention to what you say for the rest of your talk because they're thinking about themselves. But if you're talking at an Al-Anon meeting, the same thing happens. And they're leaning forward in their seat, and they're waiting for you to tell them that there was an alcoholic somewhere. My beautiful wife, Leslie, sends you her greetings from Cleveland, Tennessee, where we are new residents as of about 5 weeks ago, and sends you her best and asks you to send her husband home safe and soon because you'd like to have me there. That's a change in policy from the early days of sobriety. In July of last year, she celebrated 36 years of continuous sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a time when I would have told you that I had some credit for that because I was the motivating force behind her decision to go get sober. The reality is that my wife got sober in spite of me helping her. My wife got sober and stayed sober in the face of an asshole that was so bad that she called her sponsor every single day in early sobriety to relate my latest ill deed that I had done, whatever that was, and to lobby her sponsor for permission to leave me. And her sponsor, who was the meanest woman in Alcoholics Anonymous, she was scary sober. Ever meet anybody like that? A room full of people like this, you all chatting before the meeting, and then she comes through the door, her name was Pat. Pat would come through the door, and a hush would roll over the room. We'd look over to see how Pat's doing, because if Pat's having a bad day, everybody's having a bad day. She was scary sober, and they were afraid of her, but not me. I loved that woman because she was mean to my wife. My wife is she's in an outpatient treatment place. She should have probably been in treatment. She got sober. We'd been playing bottle tag for a while by then, and I'd been trying to help her, and she got sober while I was gone working on a job out of state. And while she was in there, a lady came in on a panel, and it was a cold, rainy, kind of a crappy night. And there were two men and a woman that came, and none of them wanted to be there. They had to come out in the rain to go do their panel at the loser hospital over there. And they came anyway, and they did a little presentation. And my wife approached the woman, and they talked for a minute. She gave her her card, and the woman said, "You call me. You call me tonight. You call me tomorrow." And Pat became her sponsor, but not in name. So for about, I don't know, for several months, Pat would say, "Okay, this is the meeting. This is a place saving you a seat for you up front. Sick ones sit up in the front." Sorry, guys. Sick ones belong in the front. That's why I'm always in the front row. And she would save my wife a seat. And after a while, my wife said, "Well, will you be my sponsor?" To which Pat replied, "Oh, honey, I don't sponsor losers, and nobody here thinks you're going to make it. But you can call me." My wife didn't find out for years that you could shop for a sponsor. She thought that was just it. It was like getting married. You're stuck with them forever. And she just did what Pat said. After a year of sobriety, I went and gave her a cake at my first ever AA meeting to go give my wife a cake in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, "Will you sponsor me now?" And Pat said, "Well, yes, but let's not tell anybody just yet." When she was lobbying her sponsor to have permission to get rid of me, her sponsor is old school, hardline AA, the way I like it, straight up, no rocks, said, "Oh, honey, we don't make any major decisions in our first year of sobriety. We're too sick to make any major decisions." But when they're as sick as you, it's 3 years. Yeah. My wife would say that to her sponsees, and their eyebrows find new real estate on their forehead going, "What? Are you crazy?" She believed, and maybe rightly so, that she could not be sober or stay sober with somebody like me for a husband. I'm not going to any meetings. I've never been to an AA meeting. I come from a family where alcoholism is the norm. It's every direction for generations. I was talking to Tiffany about my family tree. I can track alcoholics and violence back in my family tree for 2,000 years. And what happened with all of that stuff? Being with an alcoholic was like, it's like asking a fish if they're, "How's the water?" Fish goes, "What water?" Right? I'm so deeply immersed in it that I don't know. When she drank, I was ahead on points every day. I got the moral high ground. I get to make all the decisions, and she's sorry. I miss the sorry days. Arbutus O'Neill from Texas used to say that having a blackout alcoholic for a spouse is the best thing ever happened to her. It was as good as having a pocket on a shirt. Anything that goes wrong in your life, it's their fault. That's great. She says, if you don't have a blackout alcoholic, I feel sorry for you. I had a daily oblivion blackout drinker. She was my girlfriend at the time and my fiance, who drank to oblivion and passed out every single night. And I would pick her up and carry her to bed like Rhett carrying Scarlet through the doors of the mansion. It was all very romantic, and put her in bed. And we did that dance for a while. And then one day she came up to me and she said, I think I'm an alcoholic. By then she'd admitted to me that she'd been drinking a lot. And I said, no, you're not. No, you're not. She said, what? I said, no, you just, all you gotta do is just stop drinking. You're not an alcoholic, just don't drink anymore. And she's, you gotta cut down or you gotta quit drinking. And she scratched her head and went off. And I went off on that job and she called. She sat in her bed for 3 days with a bottle trying to drink enough to not wake up, to commit suicide with alcohol poisoning. For 3 days, everything she could put in her body, and she kept waking up not dead and not happy about it. And as a last resort, she called AA. She'd had a fleeting experience with AA before that with her previous husband. And her husband's father was sober, but her husband was a terrible drunk. So if that didn't work, then AA didn't work, and she dismissed that. And she checked herself into this place. And I came home from the job, and I have no idea what's going on, but she's finally crossed that line where I've had enough. You know, our life has gotten, I told somebody before the meeting, our life got really small. People start peeling off the edges that don't like being around her when she's drunk, and they don't like me being around them when she's with me. And pretty soon we were down to just me and her and the cat. And the cat hated my guts too. And she went and checked herself in, so I come home from this job. When she first moved in, she would make us a cocktail at night. Now, I'm not an alcoholic, and I'm not much of a drinker. I've never been much of a drinker. It never did the magic for me. Remember the magic? You heard it when Bob talked about that first double shot that went down, and he went, and his shoulders fell down from his ears from the first time, and he described a spiritual conversion, which is no less than what it is, to the alcoholic. And I watched that in my life, amongst my grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, later brothers and sisters, and my children. And I aspired to achieve that. I couldn't wait to grow up and be an alcoholic. I didn't put that name on it. I didn't call it an alcoholic. I just wanted to grow up and be like them, be able to do what they did. And they had these wild adventures. They had courage that I couldn't begin to master. They didn't give a crap what anybody thought about them, no matter what they did. They could stand up in the middle of that room and just belt out a song out of key and didn't care, and I would be horrified to do anything to even draw the attention of you. And alcohol seemed to do that magic for them, and I couldn't wait. I'm a little kid. I can't wait. By the time I turned 21, I'd been 3 years in the United States Marine Corps during the end of Vietnam, and I'd already done all the serious drinking I was ever going to do, and I discovered it didn't work for me, so I adopted a new role. I'm hanging out with these guys. It's 1972. We're still the culture of the 60s. It's drugs, and it's dope, and booze, and parties, and having a good time. And I can't keep up with these guys. I can't do what they do. I can't consume alcohol in any quantity and not just fall asleep. I throw up and I puke. I puke and I fall asleep. It's not a very exciting date. So I have to find a way to have value in my world. And my value became, I'm going to take care of those guys. And I became the self-appointed designated driver. Not only for getting them home from the bar, but for running dope. We were stationed at 29 Palms, California. We'd make a run up into L.A. where a couple of guys were from L.A. and they'd hit a couple of connections and they'd fill the trunk up with some dry goods, as my AA friends call them, and we'd go back to the base. And I didn't do the dope. I didn't like the dope. Didn't like how I feel. It made me dizzy. I don't like being car sick. Didn't like the dope. I didn't buy the dope. I didn't sell the dope. I drove the car. We would go across the desert out there through Joshua Tree and Yucca Valley at 120, 130 miles an hour in my old Ford Galaxy that I built the motor for it, because we found out that when you came through them little speed trap towns, running over a buck and a half, they didn't bother to chase you. It was too much work. They'd get somebody who was 10 miles over the speed limit, get them. I'm driving across the desert with a load of dope in the trunk and going on to United States Marine Corps base loaded with narcotics. If they catch us, I'm going to go be making little ones out of big ones at Leavenworth, just like them, and I know that. We never got caught doing that, and I spent a lot of time taking care of them guys, but it gave me the permission to breathe your air, because when I look in here, I don't deserve anything. I spend my whole life terrified that you'll see and hear and you'll reject me and I got nothing. So my beautiful wife gets sober. I come home from this job. I walk in the house. By that time, we're having that cocktail every night. And I said, when we do this, I have a little headache in the morning. Just that little teeny tiny hangover thing. And I'm a morning person. And that just doesn't work for me. So I think we need to stop drinking. And my wife said, oh my God, what do you mean we? She moved her drinking into the kitchen. She introduced me to wine by the box. Remember that? She come in with a 5-gallon box of wine with a spigot on the front of it. What the heck is that? We're never going to drink that. Oh, it was such a great deal at the big box store, whatever. I got no idea. One day she came in and she offered me one of them little plastic bottles of New York seltzer water. She handed it to me to drink, and I made a face. And she says, what? I says, I'm not drinking that. She said, why? I said, I hate carbonated. It tastes like desiccated yak piss. And she said, oh, okay. And then I gave her a place to hide her vodka in the open in the fridge until she got the end of her drinking. And I never, ever found where her booze was because it's in all those bottles of New York seltzer water in the fridge. So I come home the first night. I'm fixing to tell her it's over. She's finally embarrassed me for the last time with my family. I'm not going to have any more of it. And she marches into the table. I'm sitting in the living room where we lived until just 5 weeks ago. She stands in front of the table. Now, I'm going to back up and tell you something. When my wife said she was an alcoholic and I said, no, you're not, just stop. My wife then said, I think I need help to get sober. And this is the level of arrogance I brought to you. I said, if you get help from anybody but me, you're out of here. So when my wife laid in that bed calling to get into, she wasn't calling AA, she'd already written you guys off the list, calling places to get checked in, she knew she was doing it at risk of her living arrangement and her future. She was going to be homeless. She was homeless when I got her. She was going back out on the street, basically, and she did it anyway. She marched in front of that table and she says, I know you told me that I couldn't get any help or I was out of here, but I couldn't do it by myself and I was desperate, so I've called to check myself in to get some recovery. So instead of throwing her out, I put her on double secret probation. That's 1 foot in the door and one in a banana peel. The slightest anything, out you go, she's got to go. And she'd start going to these meetings. And she would go to this thing, and she'd stay out late after. They'd go to coffee after or whatever. And she'd stay out for like all hours. She starts going to AA. Pat gives her phone. She starts going to meetings with Pat. They go to coffee after the meeting. And the meeting's over at 8:30. She come mosey in around 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. I did not complain. I told them, she's clearly broken. You keep her as long as it takes to fix her. Don't send her home before she's done. I had no problem with her staying out until 2 o'clock in the morning. What I know now looking back is that there was a guy in her group. There was like all these men, and she was the only woman in the center. She's getting treated for alcoholism. And she adopted a loser boy living with his mom, didn't have a car, and she would pick him up and take him to meetings and stuff. And I don't know why I'm sharing this, but I'll share it with you. She was with him when she went to coffee and stayed out until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning in new sobriety. And I've learned that my commitment to be in a relationship, in or out, is a black and white one. And I've never, ever, ever asked her, nor will I ever ask her if anything happened between her and him. Because at some point in the future, beyond that, when I got into recovery, I was put in a position where I had to decide, am I in or out? My commitment to the relationship is a binary commodity. It's a zero or it's a one. It's all the way in or all the way out. If I'm all the way in, I'm in with a woman who has whatever her past is, who's an alcoholic, she lives her life like they've peeled her skin off and her nerves hurt when they contact the air. She's not pleasant to be around. And I had to make a decision to be all the way in. But I tell you, she made it first. That whole first year, she's calling her sponsor, asking for permission to get rid of me, and her sponsor's telling her, no, come to the meeting, do the work. We're not looking at him, we're looking at you. And she's doing that thing. And after about 8 months of us tearing the house up, and I mean, I'm like smashing the kitchen. We'd have a fight. We fought every day. We'd work Monday through Friday, Saturday, We're together. Saturday night, she's calling her dad looking to come back home to Nebraska. Jack's going to throw her out. I'm hoping she finds a place to go. It's ugly. She made the mistake of telling me. Her sponsor directed her to tell me that the reason she picked fights with me because I still had a closet full, I had a cabinet full of booze in my kitchen. In the movie business, you wrap up a show and the actors or the crew chiefs or whatever would get bottles of tequila or bourbon or whatever, and they would give it out to the crew like it was candy bars. They don't do that anymore, but they did in those days. And you, if you wanted to promote work with the transportation departments and studios, you went around with a, you sent two pretty girls with a case of bourbon and you passed it out to all the guys that ran the transportation department. It was part of the atmosphere that we worked in. And I asked her when she got sober, because I don't care about it. Do I need to get rid of that? And she said no. And then she tells me, the reason I picked those fights with you is because if you get mad enough, it'll be okay for me to drink the booze in that cabinet. Sponsor directed, she shared that with me. And I went, duly noted. The very next time she picked a fight with me, I said, wait, I got this. I went and got a 33-gallon trash can out of my garage. I got a 28-ounce framing hammer with an aluminum, with a fiberglass handle. And I set the can in the middle of the kitchen, and I opened that cabinet. And I grabbed each one of those bottles out of that cabinet and threw it in the air just high enough to get both hands on the handle of the hammer and smash it on the way down. I did it over the trash can, but not much went in the trash can. It went in the, stuck in the ceiling. It went on the walls and the floors. It was in my hair. I annihilated my kitchen at 8 months of her sobriety. She's in the bedroom talking on the telephone to her sponsor, working on a spiritual solution to her problem of alcoholism. And I'm telling everybody, it's not my problem. Fix her, she's the problem. And I'm smashing my kitchen. At 1 year of sobriety, she asked me to come give her a cake, which I thought I was entitled to give her. I know, I really know a lot different now. There was a lady who talked at the podium. Her name was Dorothy Scott. She's also not with us. Dorothy spent the entire her entire AA talk at my first ever Alcoholics Anonymous meeting talking about her Al-Anon husband, Jerry. And she talked about how she hated his guts. And she related his crimes in some colorful detail during the meeting. And then she said, I'll never forget it. She said, I remember the moment it changed. She says, I was in the living room watching him putter around the kitchen, and this thought came to me. You know, the little son of a bitch is kind of cute. My people, I find my people find me. I just show up, my people find me. So a year and a half of her sobriety, she started dragging me to open AA meetings where I'm hearing the music of recovery and open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm learning about a disease I don't have from the people that have it, right? And I'm fascinated, but I loved it. The laughter, the coffee after the meeting, oh my God, that was like the bomb watching what went on in there. The stories that went back and forth and the 12-step work, I didn't know what it was then, but the 12-step work I saw happening at coffee, not in the meeting. It happened after the meeting at coffee. I loved it. I told my wife, I said, man, I love what you have. I wish I could do it. And she said, well, why don't you join? I says, what if they find out that I never drank? She said, oh my God, I would lie for you. My wife is so desperate for me to get any help, she was going to go to AA and lie and tell them I was a terrible drunk so I would get some kind of help. However, I'm an Al-Anon. I listen to what they're saying up there, and I keep notes. And I remember them talking about rigorous honesty, and I was afraid if she lied to those people, she'd get drunk. I was afraid that she'd get drunk, so I wouldn't do it. Year and a half of her sobriety, decided I needed to go to a meeting. So I snuck a phone call out, found our central office, and I ordered a directory sent to my house in the mail. They used to do that. And then I got to the mailbox every day first to get it so she wouldn't know. I didn't want her and Lizzie Borden, her sponsor, to know I was going to Al-Anon. And I snuck out to my first meeting. And I went to the right address at the right time to the right room on the right night, and nobody was there. I'd been to AA for about 6 months. I loved what they had. Nobody had ever heard of Al-Anon at the AA meeting. There were no like wives there that were Al-Anon. There was nobody. We had nobody. I went to the second meeting a night or two later. Nobody was there. I went to three meetings that were listed in that directory as current meetings, and there was nobody at any of them. And I started to think that maybe you guys were the figment of somebody's imagination. I thank God every day that I made the decision on that fourth night, it was a Tuesday, to try one more time. And I went to this little dingy church. It's always a little dingy church. They had an AA meeting. When you came in the foyer, down that hall, that lighted hallway, is the gong show. That's a rowdy, happy, loud AA meeting, and I'm comfortable down there. I love those people. I could go melt right in there and be just fine. But down this way, down this hall, where there's no lights on, this long hallway, is a door way at the end that's open. So I tiptoe down the hallway. And I'm not fully committed to this whole thing just yet, so when I get to the door, I grab the jamb and I just take a little peek around the corner to see what's in there. And I will tell you that when we did my inventory, I discovered that one of my defects of character is an overly developed sense of responsibility. That's a defect of character for me and for you and for everything in the world. And as I peeked around the door, they looked up and they saw me. I will tell you to this day that if they hadn't noticed me, I'd have just slipped right back out and gone down the hall to the gong show, and I'd have been just fine. And what I saw in there was exactly what I knew it was going to be. So help me, it was eight little blue-haired ladies sitting in a circle with nine chairs for the new hostage. I walked in. I think it's from here to Tiffany. I think it took me 10 minutes to make it. It was like the Green Mile. Oh, man. I got nothing in common with these people. They can't possibly have done the things I've done and seen the things I've seen. They can't possibly be carrying the shame and the guilt and the hurt that I've got. I've got nothing in common with these people. I took my chair. I found out after not too much time that I had the great good fortune to fall into the arsenic and old lace division of the Al-Anon family groups. They actually wrote their own 20 questions. The first one was, have you ever actively plotted the death of your alcoholic? You might need Al-Anon. I was home, baby. I was home. That Saturday, I picked a meeting to go to because I'm a long-distance bicycle rider. I haven't ridden in 4 months because of this move, but I do 3,000 to 5,000 miles or more a year on a bicycle at race training speed. I love to ride. It's where I meditate now. It's the only place I can make the voices go away. Yeah, we got voices too. If you're an AA, you don't got the market cornered on that. I got the loudest guy is a kill 'em all guy. We just try and keep him off to the side. So I pick a meeting I can ride to, take in a meeting, ride home. It's 18 miles over the mountain down to the meeting, hour and a half meeting, about a 40-mile loop coming back. I get a 65-mile ride in, get a meeting in. Good, didn't waste my Saturday. I have a problem, though. I'm coming to AA with her, and there are people in there that were new. They stick up anybody under 30 days. They stick their hand up. They make them introduce themselves. God help us all, they'd make them read the traditions and butcher anonymity 7 ways from Sunday. I saw that. And then I went there long enough to see him be new again. And be new again. And that was really unattractive to me. One of the speakers one night, he noticed, he knew what was going on, and he said, he introduced himself, said he was an alcoholic, and he said, you know who in this room wants to be sober more than anybody in here? Those people that just stood up again to take a newcomer chip again want it more than any of you, and I hope you never forget it. And I never did. So I'm going to come to Al-Anon. I am not going to stick my hand up as a newcomer. I have never in almost 35 years, stuck my hand up as a newcomer in Al-Anon because I don't want you to notice that I'm there. I have a problem with not being noticed. I'm going to show up at the meeting on my bicycle in an appropriate wardrobe for riding a bicycle. A spandex, heat shrink to fit, no secrets in the world, road cone colored roadie bicycle suit, to be the anonymous, secret, underground newcomer guy at the meeting with the women. Fundamentally, I've got some feeling in my head that might not work out. So I come up with a plan. Any planners here? Yeah, the rest of you, there's a lot more hands need to be up for that. There's planners, right? Here's the plan. I'm going to get a backpack. I'm going to fill it full of street clothes. I'm going to get to the meeting an hour before the meeting starts. At this little church, yet we were in a little kid's classroom at the end of the church. There was a meditation garden on the end of it with a wall around it. Rose bushes. It was beautiful. And I would get there early. I'd hide my bike in the bushes. I'd strip butt naked in the meditation garden and switch into my street clothes. And when the first person showed up at the meeting to open the door, I'm in the door. And I'm busy. Baby, I am busy. I'm setting up the chairs. I'm straightening the literature. I'm helping with the coffee. I'm busy, 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 busy. Don't talk to me. I'm happy and well-adjusted. I'm fine. That's F-I-N-E. Ask your sponsor what that means. I don't want to meet you. Don't want to talk to you. Don't want to pray with you. I was horrified when they mentioned God at that AA meeting. I went home trying to figure out how I was going to do the 12 steps while I weave through the God cones. And I'll tell you why in a minute. And then when the meeting was over, I'd wait till the last one of you left. I'd go back out in the meditation garden and strip butt naked and get into my roadie suit, put the backpack on, go finish my ride. I did that for a couple of months until I had my first spiritual awakening. I realized that that was my chair. It's me and 70 women. And I earned that chair with my decisions and my behavior, and it was mine to take, and they couldn't and would not take it away from me. No, she's sober. I'm sicker than you. I'm a guy in estrogen world. They couldn't take that chair away. And on that day, I left the backpack home, and I showed up as who I am. I'm a guy that rides bicycles. And on that day, my friend Patty M., I just saw her at the memorial for my friend Mindy the other day. She moved to Texas. Big red-headed Patty walked up, and she patted me on my spandex butt, and she said, "Oh, you keep coming back, honey." Just to follow that story up, I was a member of that group for 25 years, and I switched some meetings around because I was the chair setter-upper guy. If I didn't set them up, they weren't right. If I was gone, they knew. And the church said, the regular room is busy. We'd graduated a much bigger room at the church. Can you guys go back to the old little classroom? And I thought, well, this would be nostalgic and to go back to the old classroom and where it all started, where I really started, where I got my sponsor was a lady in that meeting in that classroom. And I'm setting up the room and I'm gazing down. It's a long, skinny room. And at the end of it, there's a little two-step dais. And there's this beautiful bay window with one-way glass on it, facing out into the meditation garden. And I had to raise my hand in the meetings and make amends to the members of the group for being the batshit crazy naked Al-Anon boy in the bushes outside the window, because if they showed up early and there was more than one door, they got the whole show. I mentioned to one of the long-timers one time about my early days there, and I said, I wasn't happy at home. I probably would have tried to sleep with you guys, except it seemed you all had sponsors and were doing the steps, and I got no place else to go. I don't want to burn this bridge. And this very long time, a friend of mine, Susie, she said, "Oh, honey, you were so cute. You could have had any of us." And I said, 20 years you waited to tell me this? Really? So I've been here from then till now. That sponsor told me, I asked a lady to sponsor me. There was one guy, I asked him to sponsor me. He'd never done the steps. He didn't have a working knowledge of what I needed to do, and I needed more than I was getting. And more than I needed what I was hearing in the meeting about steps and recovery and sponsorship. And I took a chance and asked a lady to sponsor me. I know that's going to be the end of the story right there, because she's going to say, "Oh, honey, sorry, but I don't sponsor no boys." And what my sponsor said to me is the only correct answer to the question, "Will you work with me," that I've ever given in the last 34 years and 11 months. Is, "I would be honored to work with you," is what she said. And she led the way when they railroaded me into service commitments. I started traveling in service. I wound up, by 1995, I was the chairman of the Los Angeles Intergroup. We had 400 and some odd meetings. We had three full-time employees at our central office, our literature distribution center, and I was the chairman. And then I went on to go do service at World Service, and I wound up with a different sponsor later. And service has saved my life all of this time. So I'm going to back up a minute and tell you a story about before I got here. I've shared about this already this weekend, as some of you know. In 1976, fresh out of the Marine Corps, I was just starting to work at my job and begin my career in the movie business. And my then wife, my first wife, was working at a hardware store. And we had a 16-year-old little neighbor girl watching our kids. not watching our kids. And she was in the house on the phone or watching TV, and my baby girl drowned in a foot and a half deep plastic pool you could pick up at the thrifty market because she wasn't being watched. And the police and the paramedics came, and they were the first ones to give her CPR. They took her to Children's Hospital, and they put her on a ventilator. She couldn't breathe. She wasn't breathing. She was in a coma. And she spent a year in a coma, right? She was there for about 6 weeks, and the hospital announced they were going to move her to a state hospital. What they were saying is that she's not going to get better, and we need the space at Children's Hospital. And that was unacceptable to my then wife, who I believe is the adult child of an alcoholic father. And she said, "You're not taking her to that. We'll take her home. We will take care of her," she said. We called the March of Dimes, a charity that helped my family out when I got severely burned as a kid. I wasn't supposed to live. I had third-degree burns over half my body. And we called them up, and they got us the medical equipment necessary to take care of a profoundly comatose child with a feeding tube in her stomach and a trach tube in her neck. We got heart monitors, breathing monitors, and the bane of my existence, the suction machine I described the other day. And she slept in a crib by my side of the bed. The child required 24-hour-a-day constant care, and I couldn't do it. If you're an alcoholic, and you put alcohol in your body, particularly in a crisis, and it made the crisis go away, you'd probably picked up a drink and drank it. And it would have solved, short-term, would have solved the problem for you. I guarantee you, this is the scariest thing I'll ever say to a room that's got people that are sober alcoholics. That if alcohol had done for me what it did for you, if drugs had done for me what it did for you, I'd have been drunk then and I'd be drunk now. There was nothing to take the edge off of that. And I'd stand at the foot of her crib listening to the machines and watching that her strangle on a snot bubble she can't quite expel from her suction, from her trach tube, and I would flee the house. Now, I'm an ex-Marine. I broke my nose riding rodeo when I was 8. I was racing motorcycles when I was 8. Won my first car race at 4 years old, racing quarter midgets. I went on to ride rodeo and do some pretty rough, tough stuff. I grew up in the middle of a motorcycle gang. My dad and my uncles were founding members of the Galloping Gooses in Hollywood. And they, 1950s, these were a formidable bunch of dudes. And they were at our house every day. It was full of these people. When my brothers would call up and get in a jackpot with too many guys that they'd pick to fight with, it was always me that went in and got them. And I'm not a fighter, but I'm terrified if I don't go do that, they're going to talk bad about me. They're going to tell somebody that what's really in here, that I'm terrified. And I would just go do it. And from the outside, I look like somebody who's got a lot of courage. And I don't have the courage. I'm a coward. I can't stand at the foot of my little girl's crib when she desperately needs. When that wife needed a husband, when that daughter needed a father, I couldn't be there. So when I came to AA with her, and you guys are talking about the process of the steps and amends, I'm going, yep, that would work. But you're never touching this. This load that I'm carrying, you're never going to put a finger on that. Booze and drugs, you couldn't put a finger on that. Psychotherapy is not going to put a finger on that. That's just forever. You can't do that. You're not going to touch that. I believe that thoroughly. After a year in a coma, I get a call. I'm working on a TV show up in the Santa Susana Pass, and they said, "You need to get to the hospital right away." And I jumped in a car. They gave me a driver, this lady with a station wagon. She was supposed to drive me, and I said, "Move over." I'm an Al-Anon man. I need to be in control. I got to have the wheel. Now, we made a trip 30 miles across the San Fernando Valley before there was a freeway there at 100 plus miles an hour blowing the red lights, and she closed her eyes and prayed the whole way. She thanked me later for not killing her. Because like my being at the hospital is going to make a difference. Like I've got a stethoscope and I've got some letters after my name are going to make a difference. It's not. And I talked about my dad in the workshop earlier and about forgiving him for philandering and cheating on my mom and all of his wives and girlfriends and for conscripting us to be part of it. But here's something that happened with him. And this is probably really the story that Karen was talking about when she talked to Pat. I arrive at the hospital. My dad is standing outside the doors of the hospital, Holy Cross Hospital, and he's standing in the doorway. And I get out of the car and I go to him. As I get to him, he turns without a word and goes into the hospital. I follow him. We go in, grab the elevator, second floor. We turn right out of the elevator. It's all right in my head. We start down the hallway, and we go past the family room where all of my family is there. My former wife is in there. My son is in there. My brothers and sisters, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents. The room is packed with my family. We don't stop. We go past it. We go to the end of the hallway. It's always the last door on the left, isn't it? Down this long hallway, we turned into a room. My dad opened the door and let me step in to find my 2-year-old little girl dead on a stainless steel table without so much as a blanket. She had coded, they'd recorded it, and they'd walked away to find out that she had died. Now, I knew that son of a bitch knew when I got to the hospital. I always knew he could have broke my fall. He could have said something. He could have said anything. The shock of seeing my little girl on that table caused me to cry. I talked about earlier what happened when you showed any crack, any emotion, any weakness whatsoever in my family. It was cataloged, weaponized, and stored. That's going to be handy in at some other time. And I cried in front of him for about 10 seconds. And then I sucked it up. Because this thing in my head tells me that if I show any crack now, it's over. My wife can't survive it. My kid, my other son can't survive it. The family, I need to be the one who's strong on this. And I pulled it in. And I hated him for seeing me cry. So now he's got 2 strikes, right? Because of the gift of sponsorship and inventory and jumping way ahead in the story, I got to talking about that with my sponsor and relating what had happened. And it was pointed out to me that what happened to my dad that day when he was standing outside the hospital was precisely the same thing that happened to me when I stood at the foot of her crib listening to the machines bing and bong and the suction machine whirring away. He could no more tell me what was going on than I could stand at the foot of that little girl's crib. And I let him up. Like I said, never know where we're going to go. In about 1995, 96, my wife picked up a woman. She was always getting newcomers in AA. She put herself on, when she had a crisis and she was flying off the planet, she called central office and said, put my number down. I want to get calls from people that call in that need help. I want you to have them call me. She starts getting 12-step calls, going places in the middle of the night. I wouldn't go in the daytime if I was armed. And I'd ask her if she's going to be safe. And my wife would say, God would never place me where God's will would never place me where God's grace won't protect me. And off she would go. She had this woman for 5 years in and out of sobriety. Can I get my water? Oh, Karen, sorry. She'd get sober, she'd get drunk, she'd have a baby, she'd get sober, she'd get drunk, she'd have a baby, went on for 5 years. My wife had a lady call her every day at 7 o'clock in the morning for her first 3 or 4 years of sobriety, every single day to check in. Go to a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day and get drunk every night for 3 years. We don't shoot our wounded here. I asked her one day, I said, why do you take her calls? Isn't she wasting your time? My wife said, because I think I'm supposed to. Last time I asked the question, I think that lady had 25 years of sobriety because my wife never refused her calls. But this lady had the 5 years in and out, in and out, in and out, had 5 children. She dropped one on New Year's Eve drunk, and he died. What a great reason to drink. Wound up on the street. He's gone, money's gone, house gone, cars gone, job's gone. She's got 4 kids, doesn't know what to do. She calls my wife and she says, I'm ready. I need help. Can you get me in somewhere? My wife called a place down in Laguna Hills where one of her other sponsees had dried out. It was Laguna House. And she asked me to take her down there and I said, no. I know now. I'm thoroughly convinced that I don't do AA 12-step work. You've heard me this weekend. I have a really good working knowledge of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have thousands of open meetings of AA under my belt. I count amongst my friends some of the sickest people you've ever met that stand at podiums around the country and around the world. I have an awful lot of stuff. What I lack is experience. I'm not equipped to do AA 12-step work. I said, if you send one of your girls with me, I'll go get her. And she sent Kit, her sponsee Kit. We showed up at the house and knocking on the door. She's not answering. I'm fixing to push Kit over the wall into the garden there so she can pick the lock on the sliding door. We all had skills when we got here. Breaking and entering was one of them. We're like Batman and Robin on a 12-step call. When the door comes open, and she's standing in the doorway butt naked. And Kit looks at me and she says, I see why I'm here. I'll dress her, you pack her. Let's go. They would not let her come in unless she was drunk. It was the rule of the house. We stopped at a liquor store, and we had to basically carry her in because she was still pretty drunk and pick a bottle of booze out for her. And the clerk at the liquor store thought we were getting her drunk enough for a threesome or something. It was very funny to watch. We drove 2.5 hours while she drank that bottle of whiskey. We got there, she was more or less unconscious. And I'd carry her in. I picked her up and carried her up to the door, and there's this little skinny, you know, she was a street junkie trying to get sober in the place. And she probably weighed, she was like 6 foot tall and weighed about 80 pounds. And she's got the clipboard to check her in, and she says, "What do you got there?" I said, "I got a precious baby girl alcoholic. I hope you can do something for her." And I took her in, I laid her on the bed, and they started asking her questions. And the lady says, "I know this is ridiculous. I know she's completely out of it. House policy, you have to ask the questions. When did you drink last? Blah, blah, blah. What's your history?" She goes on and on, goes down the list. Nothing from Tammy. Her name was Tammy, is on the bed. Still, she gets to the last question. She says, "Why are you here?" Tammy's eyes fluttered open, and she rolled her head over on the table. And through cracked lips, she said, "Because I want to get better," and passed out. You will hear a joke, you hang around Al-Anon, people will say, "How do you know when an alcoholic's lying? It's because their lips are moving." I'm not buying that. I think she meant that with every fiber of her being. She couldn't do it. I know, looking back, that every time my wife, after some terrible dust-up or debacle that happened, said she would never do it again, I know she absolutely meant it. She just could not do it. She had 4 kids. They all wound up with neighbors at the apartment building she'd been living in, with their grandmother, with the next-door neighbor. They got farmed out everywhere. And the little one, the 3-year-old, was staying with a neighbor in the apartment building, and she couldn't stay there anymore. The neighbor had to go for some reason. And they called my wife, and she said she went to the meeting. She asked around if anybody could take this 3-year-old little girl because she needed a place to go. And they said, "Why don't you bring her home?" Now, I won't relive the whole backstory, but there came a time when my wife, who had never wanted children, and I was a terrible dad. I already told you, I was an absent father. I didn't show up for my kids. I don't want to repeat that experience. I've got no interest in having children. And her biological clock came on. And we had some discussions that the future of our marriage was hanging on the outcome of that. It was really pretty rough, and we'd gotten past that patch. And she said, because he said, "No kids, never, it will never happen." And we're sitting at the dinner table, and she relates the story. I told them at AA that she needs a place to go, and they said I should bring her home, and I told them you would never agree to that. And what I said was, "I think we've been in recovery long enough that we can talk about absolutely anything." She said, "Well, what do you think we should do?" I said, "I think that the 3-year-old and the 5-year-old little girls are really closely bonded. We should bring them both." Now, I heard an alcoholic in a meeting one time say, "My name is Jim, I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober since such and such." And he says, "I'm standing before you in an unnatural state. My natural state is to be more or less insanely drunk. But because of daily maintenance of my spiritual condition, I get to be before you in an unnatural state. I believe that my natural state is the guy I just described to you. The coward and the shame and the violence and the guilt and all the baggage, that's my natural state. That's the guy whose head woke up on my pillow this morning in my hotel room. Because of daily maintenance of my spiritual condition, I don't get to live like that guy today. I hope you never get to meet him." Them 2 little girls came to our house, and they were tore up from the floor up. The little one, by the time she was 4, Mom never got sober, by the way. I don't have time to tell the whole story, but Mom never got sober. She died at the age of 41 of late-stage alcoholism. She was staying at a house, but she was mostly homeless. She's actually in Tennessee. And the younger one was diagnosed with bipolar 1 with auditory hallucinations, ADHD, fetal alcohol syndrome. This is a toxic mix of things that they can't medicate for 4, because they medicate for 1, it offends the other one. It's a very delicate condition. And it began to run for us, and I'll wrap up by telling you this and why. It wound up with us having to advocate for this little girl to get her the help that she needed. They don't diagnose children below age 7 with bipolar. She had already been hospitalized for violent behavior by the time she was 9. My wife watched it take 12 adults to capture and restrain a 65-pound little girl and strap her to a gurney and take her to a psych ER at a psych hospital. Right? That little girl is paying a terrible price for drinks she didn't drink and drugs she didn't choose because her mom did those things that she was carrying her. And it set up a circumstance where we were forced to advocate for this little girl, try to get her her medical treatment, get her. We got her in with the world's most renowned expert on pediatric bipolar. He took us on because he'd never seen a case as severe as hers. He wrote the volumes. You look at the library and there's a book on pediatric bipolar. It's 9 inches thick and his is the only name on the binder. He didn't take patients. He took her. Thank God he took her. We went through a series of things where she eventually had to go away to school because they had to physically restrain her in school. They had to capture her and put her on a gurney. And she came home at the age of 13. She'd been gone 4 years, and all they did was teach her how to accommodate a change in direction. How about that? She was in a class, they're doing math, she can't figure it out. She's pounding the table, and she's throwing a pencil, and they finally show her what she needs to do, and she's doing the math, and they said, wait, we're going to stop now, we're going to switch to social studies. And she couldn't accommodate the change in direction and wound up strapped to a gurney going out in an ambulance to a hospital. If you sponsor people and you hear inventories, I know for myself and for all these people I'm talking about, none of us accommodates that change very well. The quality of what they taught her for 3.5 years away at that special school with genius counselors and psychologists was simply to accommodate change in direction in her life. It allowed her to come back to our home and finish school, right? The only difference is I don't break out in multiple heads and violence, but I don't like it either, and probably neither do you. And all we learn around here is to accommodate a change in direction with dignity and grace. And it saved her life. Today she's living in a halfway house in California. We don't want to move her out of there because she's in a place where there's 3 clients in a beautiful house, 4 clients, and 3 staff around the clock. They cook her meals, they take care of her meds, they make sure she gets to her daycare center and stuff. She's effectively about 10 years old. And she's a lovely little girl. But she calls us up and she says, Mommy and Daddy, why can't I come live with you? She's 27 years old. She can't come live with us because the voices would occasionally tell her she needed to kill the family. She went to Harbor Freight and bought a machete. Her plan was to cut my head off as I slept so I couldn't stop her from killing her sister and her mom. Her presence in the house because of her mental disease makes her contrary to our common welfare. And if it hadn't been for the traditions, we wouldn't have survived. And here's what happened at the height of this. We went through an adoption trial. It was heinous. They tortured my wife. That lady knew my wife's AA fifth step, and she shared it all in court. And all my wife could say, yes, I did that, Your Honor, but I don't live like that anymore. And I lost my train of thought because I'm getting a little longer in the tooth now. Well, what happened is our marriage almost ended during the trial, and it's over. She calls me up. She says, I need your time on Saturday. We got to talk. And I call my sponsor. I said, we're talking Saturday. We're going to talk about divorce. It's over. Who's going to get the dog? Who's going to get the couch? Who's going to be stuck with the kids? And my sponsor, who never gives me directions, says, well, you show up at the appointed time, and you will not bring up dissolution of your marriage. I said, Willie, listen, I don't care if I bring it up. It's coming up, and I'm not a big guy in a fight. My only hope in a fight is to strike first, fast and hard, or then I'm going to get my butt kicked, and I treat my whole life like that. I know it's coming. I just want to be the first blow. He said, you will not bring up dissolution of your marriage. He'd never given me direction like that. I said, okay, Willie, sometimes when you got an old sponsor, they get their teeth into something. It's like a dog with a new gym sock. They're just not going to let go. I said, fine, I won't bring it up, but it's coming up, you know, and I hung up the phone. I sat on the couch at the appointed time. My wife walked down the hallway, and she was carrying her AA 12 and 12. And we're going to have a talk about whether our marriage survives. And my wife said, my sponsor directed me that before we have this talk, I need to read this. And she read the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, and everywhere it said Alcoholics Anonymous, she substituted the words, the family, went all the way through. Closed the book, sat on the table, and said, now let's see if we can find a spiritual solution to what is clearly a spiritual problem. I'll tell you one last funny story, and I'll get off. I was at a conference in Louisiana. On the docket was people like Sandy Beach and Deb H. from the East Coast, from Virginia, I think, like all-star cast of speakers, and they're rotating workshops, 12 step one, step two, step three, tradition this, tradition that. all day long, and I'm standing in the buffet line during lunch, and there's a workshop going on the traditions, and there's two women in front of me dressed to the nines. They're here, they're not here for recovery, they're here hunting. They're hunting, right? Big hair, big eyes, big boobs, legs that come all the way up to the bottom of the boobs. They were here, they're good to go. And I hear over, now nobody knows me at this conference, and I overhear them talking, oh my God, did you hear Sandy talking about step four, and this and that, and the other workshop is just so wonderful, but God, when they start talking about those traditions, they're just so dry. I'm standing right behind them in the line by myself, and I said, did you know that those 12 traditions could get you laid? And their heads get, they're like Linda Blair. Their heads came all the way around before their bodies followed. They went, what? They said, how is that possible? I said, come to the traditions workshop later today. Because what happened in my world is that I'm wrong size in my world. I do the 12 steps. It makes me right size with me and with God. First time that had ever happened. A God of my understanding that I got only as a result of taking the actions I didn't believe would work and resulting in a spiritual awakening at the end of it. But I'm right sides with me and with God, but with nobody else. The application of those traditions introduced into my house by my sober wife made me the right size in my other relationships, including my marriage and my house, where everybody's the same and everybody's equal. And you know what happened? We've always been this. Mad dad and troubled little girl. You know, temper tantrum mom and guy hiding and fleeing the house. It's never been anything but this. And the application of those traditions for the first time made us the right size in the house. And I will tell you what I told them at the workshop, which is that leveling of the playing field and everybody being bestowed with full citizenship in the house without reservations opened the door to a level of partnership, communications, intimacy and sex that had never existed before. I had no idea. Them traditions can get you laid. Thank you so much for your hospitality. I'm tired of hearing me. I suppose you are too.